evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, April 18th, 2016. More than 200 civilians killed and 100 children abducted from Gambela, Ethiopia, by South Sudanese gunmen.
The number has risen to of the dead has risen to 208, and 102 children have been abducted, mostly women and children.
And Riek Machar does not arrive in Juba today.
Of course, all of you know that our leader, he's based in Pagak, in South Sudan. To access Pagak to Juba, you need to pass through Gambela in Ethiopia. So all this contributed to his to cancellation of his arrival.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese gunmen, believed to be Murley tribesmen, attacked civilians in Ethiopia's Gambela region on Friday, killing more than 200 people and abducting more than 100 children. Ethiopia's prime minister addressed the nation yesterday regarding the investigation of the attack. VOA's Henok Fente of VOA's Horn of Africa services tells South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam that the death toll has risen since Saturday.
The prime minister and Ethiopian media are saying that the number has risen to of the dead has risen to 208, and 102 children have been abducted, mostly women and children.
That's a huge body count. Has this attack been confirmed, and why did they carry this out? Was this to do with cattle raids?
Cattle raids and also abducting children and raising them. The prime minister, when he addressed the nation last night on Sunday evening, he said some traditional practices that we do not live by today and that do not hold to our realities today. He said his security forces are on top of it. They have been pursuing some of these gunmen of the Murley ethnic group, and they are in touch with South Sudanese authorities to make sure that an unconditional and peaceful return of the abductees.
I understand in the statement as well that they said no stone unturned, that we are going to get these guys and we're going to bring back the abducted children. Does that mean that they have the right to go into South Sudan to pursue the suspected gunmen?
Ethiopian communications minister over the weekend had indicated that Ethiopian forces have killed about 60 of the Murley gunmen, and that they may, and I quote, they may cross into South Sudanese territory to pursue them. The prime minister said they will pursue them wherever they are. And added to that, the prime minister said they are in touch with Juba and talking to South Sudanese officials and others, he said, to make sure that there is an understanding of the security breach here, and that South Sudanese authorities cooperate and work with Ethiopian authorities to make sure that some of the perpetrators face justice and that actions be taken.
Is this a somewhat common occurrence in that area?
We have covered similar stories previously, but not to this magnitude. Small killings, raids, cross-border raids happening between the Murley and other ethnic groups living in the South Sudan and Ethiopia border.
I understand that the numbers, like you say, are pretty high. And besides the abducted children, which could be more than 100, and the number of deaths that could be more than 200, as many as 208, that a number of livestock were also stolen.
There hasn't been any confirmed reports of that or any statements being made, but I assume that is also a part of the raid. So cattle raiding is at the heart of it.
Is there any indication that this is a retaliatory attack of any sort?
There hasn't been an earlier incident that was reported of Ethiopian ethnic groups crossing into South Sudan. This is the first of its kind. As you know, cattle raids happen in counter acts and attacks. So we have not seen reports of any attacks from the Ethiopian side.
That's VOA's Henok Fente speaking to South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam in Washington earlier today. We contacted South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay for more on this development. McQuay said he did not have enough information to comment. VOA's Henok Fente also says the Ethiopian prime minister made it very clear that there is no connection between Friday's attack in Ethiopia and the expected return of first vice president designate Riek Machar to Juba. former rebel leader Riek Machar's return to Juba has been delayed again. SPLMIO officials say the first vice president designate's return to the capital was delayed by a day due to logistical challenges. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Tight security was visible around Juba today with Riek Machar's expected arrival. Hundreds of military personnel could be seen stationed along the roads leading to and from the airport. Security operatives also prevented motorists from driving near the airport. Many passengers and residents heading to and from the airport were forced to walk about half a kilometer to the boarding terminal. At the airport's presidential terminal, a red carpet was rolled out this morning to receive the first vice president designate. At least 100 journalists, security forces, government and SPLMIO officials turned up at the airport several hours ahead of time in anticipation of Machar's arrival. SPLMIO advance team spokesman William Ezekiel informed reporters around 10 a.m. that Machar would not be coming today for logistical reasons.
Of course, all of you know that our leader is based in Pagak in South Sudan. To access Pagak to Juba, you need to pass through Gambela in Ethiopia. So all this contributed to his cancellation of his arrival.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwey told the South Sudan in Focus that Machar would be coming to Juba today.
Machar is coming today. He is at present crossing the border to Gambela Makot Airport. And from there, he will be flying in this afternoon. This afternoon, I said, not tonight even.
In the early afternoon, both government and empty opposition officials said they were confident Machar would arrive between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. local time. But later, Ezekiel told the reporters the trip had been cancelled again.
The coming of his vice president designate, Riek Machar Tany, which is supposed to take place today, has been cancelled and rescheduled for tomorrow.
Ezekiel says heavy rainfall across South Sudan also led to the cancellation of Machar's flight. Another statement from SPLAIO deputy spokesman Dixon Gadluak said incomplete logistical arrangements from the SPLAIO headquarters in Pagak caused Machar's arrival to be delayed. Gadluak says the plane which was supposed to pick up SPLAIO General Chief of Staff, General Simon Gatwech Dual, from Gambela's Makot Airport has not been granted a landing permission by the Ethiopian government. Dual and other high-ranking SPLAIO military officers were supposed to be flown to Juba before Machar's arrival. Dual is one of the SPLAIO generals who have been sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council for atrocities committed during the two-year conflict between the government and Machar's empty opposition. It marks the second time Machar's long-awaited return to Juba has been postponed. He was supposed to arrive early last week, but that date was also cancelled. His delayed return and swearing-in prolonged expected formation of the transitional government of national unity. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Maguma Davis Wakaringe contributed to this report. A South Sudanese legal expert says the transitional government of national unity must facilitate the formation of a hybrid court for South Sudan. Legal expert Ajo Noel Julius says justice and accountability are key to achieving a lasting peace in South Sudan. Noel says President Salva Kiir and Machar should help the Monitoring and Evaluation Commission to set up the hybrid courts as stipulated in the August peace deal. He tells South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza the transitional government of national unity should not interfere with the work of the hybrid court.
If the people responsible for these crimes are the senior government officers, then given the fact that they control a lot of power, this is going to be a big obstacle to the process of providing justice to the victims. Because people are talking of Riek Machar coming in as a first vice president. He will definitely be in control of a lot of state apparatus, and he has his forces here. And let us take, for example, if he's one of the suspects. How will he be availed before the court when he has a lot of support? If President Kiir or any of the army officers has made a suspect by the hybrid court, how will they be held accountable when they have a lot of power or control a lot of state apparatus? So this is where it gives us a lot of doubt, especially when we talk of accountability in the transitional period.
Peace comes with justice, and justice comes with accountability. You cannot separate these three elements. Most people are wondering, when Dr. Riek assumes power, what is going to happen? But you people who are in the legal practice and in the academia, you think fast. Can you give us some of your focus in terms of the government delivering justice to the people who have been hurt, or to the victims, so to speak?
Well, I'm still confident that justice will be delivered, though justice might not be delivered in the way that everybody will expect. Probably the president, the first vice president, will sacrifice some people. Probably people will be identified as to have committed crimes. And probably they'll be like, well, you know, my friend, I have no problem, really. But I think you should go and clear your name before the hybrid court. And you have my support. And there you go before the hybrid court. You're found guilty. And it'll be like, I'm afraid the court found you guilty. There's no way I can help you. So please serve the sentence as pronounced. That will be what will probably happen. I am looking at a scenario where some people will be sacrificed in the name of justice, in the name of healing. But if those people will be sacrificed, indeed committed crimes, then they will not be sacrificed. They will be serving sentences against crime that they are said to have committed. But of course, who is responsible will be determined by the court. Not until we know who the prosecutors are and what evidence they will be relying upon to prosecute suspects and who the defense lawyers are, who will also be availed the same evidence to share with their clients. Not until then shall we be able to know who the suspects are and what crimes, of course, will be said to have been committed by them, by the said suspects.
And people have been talking about this hybrid court, its formation, and the African Union report, the Commission of Inquiry on South Sudan, is very clear about a hybrid court to try those who must have committed crime during the violence. But some people are saying South Sudan is a sovereign state. It has its own judiciary. It has its own mechanism of resolving issues. What is your take on these two school of thoughts?
Well, I think, one, we appreciate the fact that South Sudan is a sovereign state. Two, the people who are engaged in these peace talks, the principal parties are South Sudanese parties. The government, the people in government, the IO, and the former detainees are all South Sudanese. And I think probably they know the system, or the system that we have cannot deliver. That's why they said we should have a structure in place that will deliver justice to the victims. That's why they came with the opinion of having a hybrid court. Or probably because they know our system is not competent enough, or maybe it is biased, or it can be influenced. That's why they're thinking of having an independent court which will be manned by people who are not South Sudanese. The justices, for example, who might not be South Sudanese, so that they don't, you know, buy into the biases that South Sudanese have. That's why they're thinking of, well, let's have a hybrid court. Probably the justice will not be South Sudanese. Probably they will not understand the biases that we have, so that we can have justice. And they will apply the law as it is, because they do not know who the suspects are and what ethnicity they come from, so that no one cries a foul that, you know what, I am convicted because I'm from this ethnic group, I'm convicted because I am not from here, and this and this. And I think that is what I'm thinking is the reason behind the hybrid court. On the issue of vis-a-vis the sovereignty of the country, the court does not take away the sovereignty of the state, neither does it challenge it. It's just providing a solution to where there's a deficiency. And as I said earlier, that it seems the parties do not have confidence in our system, and probably they think that for there to be, and this court is being set specifically to, you know, handle crimes that are committed within a specific period, then we need to have a special hybrid court that will be able to, you know, in a very quick and fast way, can be able to settle and provide answers to the victims who desire justice. I think that is why we have this.
That's Ajo Noel Julius, a South Sudanese independent legal expert, speaking to my colleague John Tanza on assignment in Juba. Reporter Jacob Achek asked several South Sudanese in Bor whether or not they believe Riek Machar's arrival in Juba is a positive step towards achieving peace in South Sudan.
I'm called John Madula Jack. Coming of Dr. Riek Machar is very important step toward achieving the peace in South Sudan. Because, you know, our country emerged just recently out of civil war. We need to develop. We need to move forward like other countries. So here I could see there will be changes. Changes in the sense that our economic situation will change.
I'm very much sure about that peace coming to South Sudan won't solve any problem at all, because he has his all ill intention on what he is going to do. So I don't feel good, by the way.
I'm John Mayor. We felt some hope in the implementation of the agreement. So we feel some hope, and we think his arrival will change our economy, because our partners might support the government to be formed.
I am Lon Mena Lier, and I feel so good about the coming of Riek Machar Chen, since he has accepted the peace. So when he's going to agree the peace, then I hope all of us South Sudanese, we are going to be in peace and harmony.
By name, Manyang Malwes, Jonglei State. I really feel very sad about the coming of Dr. Riek Machar, because the coming of SPLM in position chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, it will fuel the crisis of South Sudan in terms of political opinion from a different politician. So I really say that the coming of Dr. Riek Machar, it will increase the problem of South Sudan, because many politicians will be rebelled against.
I'm Michael Magret. It's a good news. When Riek is coming, I think we know there will be an implementation of the peace agreement or Douglas peace implementation modality. So we are feeling we are actually need him to come.
Those are the voices of some South Sudanese expressing their views on what Riek Machar's return to Juba means for their country. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Sudanese reporters say another crackdown is happening on journalists working in Khartoum. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the ideal presidential term limit and why?
My ideal presidential term should be 10 years, because it will enable whoever becomes president to be able to accomplish his vision and mission for the country.
4 to 5 years, because for that kind of period, someone will have had enough time to implement his plans, because, you know, development is a journey.
I think a 4-year term is okay.
I have to say 2 years. After the 2 years, we can see if he is good, then we're going to add another year.
To me, I see it should be just a life presidency, just because when we give a president a term, there are certain strategies that can't be implemented.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus. A former European Union special representative to Sudan and South Sudan says South Sudan's transitional government has some enormous economic and political challenges ahead of itself. Dame Rosalind Marsden, an associate fellow at the London-based think tank Chatham House, does not have the final list of the SPLM-IO officials who will be appointed to the new cabinet. But she says there could be many familiar faces on the final list that Riek Machar will announce.
So in one sense, the new cabinet could look like a return to previous cabinets back in 2013, but unfortunately with a huge amount of bad blood and the economy now in a real mess. So I think the key question is whether the next cabinet can show the political will and the leadership to cooperate with each other and to make the peace agreement work.
What should the new government do to address South Sudan's economic crisis?
One of the things that I'm sure they will want to prioritize is trying to ramp up oil production again. But they will also need to recognize the need for strict austerity measures and strict control over expenditure. And there will need to be strict mechanisms regarding transparency and accountability. These will need to be put in place to tackle corruption and ensure that public funds are properly spent. And of course, as long as the economic situation isn't addressed, the humanitarian situation, which is very serious in terms of food insecurity, will only worsen. And the final sort of point I'd make on what needs to be done to tackle the economic crisis is that improving relations between South Sudan and Sudan will also be important.
If Machar does indeed return, and if the transitional government is set in place, will his return convince the donor, the international donor community, to support South Sudan?
Western donors are expected to focus mainly on trying to support implementation of the peace agreement that was signed last August and the institutions that have been set up under that peace agreement. But I think that they're likely to want to proceed cautiously, and they will want to see clear signs of serious commitment from the transitional government to the reform agenda. There was quite an ambitious reform agenda sort of set out in the peace agreement. They're also likely to be looking for evidence that the transitional government accepts the need for austerity measures, for budget discipline, for strict oversight arrangements and accountability for public funds. But I think if the president appoints competent and qualified people to hold the key economic portfolios in the Ministry of Finance and in the central bank, then that's likely to be seen as an important step in the right direction. If the IMF decides to put in a structural program and the transitional government has got the right people in place to work with the IMF, then I expect that the donors will start to look at how to put the country back on track. But I think the essential requirement will be political commitment. The transitional government will have to work hard to regain donor trust. And, of course, it remains to be seen if the government in Juba will be willing to accept a financial rescue or bailout under the sort of strict terms that Western donors are likely to require. The government may be hoping that a potential deal with Sudan and the recent signs of a beginning of a rise in oil prices, a recovery in oil prices, will help to ease the situation. So there are still a lot of uncertainties and tough negotiations to be had, but the formation of the transitional government of national unity will at least get things to the starting block.
That was Dame Rosalind Marsden, the former European Union special representative to Sudan and South Sudan and former British ambassador to Sudan, speaking to me last week from London. The Sudanese Journalist Network is decrying what they say is a renewed crackdown on freedom of expression by Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service over the past 2 weeks. The Journalist Union says Al-Takir and Al-Sahya daily newspapers are the latest victims of government censorship. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Khartoum.
A statement from the Sudanese Journalists Network condemns the confiscation of a Tahrir newspaper, which occurred twice last week, as well as the confiscation of a Sayha newspaper 2 days ago. It also condemns the routine summoning of journalists by the National Intelligence and Security Service, who are then questioned about articles they wrote or published. The statement also calls on the government to lift the ban on a Tayyar newspaper, which has been shut down since December of last year. Veteran journalist Faisal Mohamed Saleh, who helps train reporters in Khartoum, says censorship has been the order of the day in Sudan since South Sudan became independent in 2011 and Sudan's ruling National Congress Party ruled with an iron fist. He says certain topics are no-go zones for journalists.
To do some type of independent reporting on what's going on in the war field, in Darfur, or in the Blue Nile or Nuba Mountain, or even sometimes you are not allowed to issue or print a statement by the rebel leaders if they are talking about something happening in the war field.
Saleh says the recent so-called national dialogue initiated by President Omar al-Bashir is another topic the government refuses to any journalists to criticize.
All newspapers receive instruction from the security that only positive reporting from the national dialogue are allowed, and any negative reporting will be, newspapers and journalists will be punished.
Saleh says talk of government corruption is another red line.
There are many corruption cases which newspaper open and start reporting about, then instruction come, don't talk about that or don't deal with such issue. So it differs, and it depends on the time.
Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal denies his government is trying to shut down freedom of the press.
We have no intention in the government to make war against journalism, journalists whatsoever.
At the same time, Bilal says the political situation in Sudan is delicate and any negative reporting might disrupt the peace.
Now, the general environment in Sudan is towards international dialogue, peace, stability, and these things. Others want to bring us back again, tensions and these things, and that's why from the side of the security point of view, they shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Bilal confirms that issues related to security in the army are off limits to journalists. According to Sudanese media laws, any issue that national security operatives take up with journalists should be dealt with in a court of law. But journalists in Sudan, as well as international human rights advocates, say in many cases, national security agents take the law into their own hands, while government officials simply look the other way. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
And here's a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Ayan. The death toll from a cattle raid carried out by suspected South Sudanese gunmen in the Gambela area of Ethiopia on Friday has risen to 208 people. An Ethiopian official says the attackers also kidnapped more than 100 children. Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn addressed the nation yesterday, saying the government has been in touch with the government in Juba to pursue and arrest the assailants. On Saturday, Ethiopian troops crossed the border in pursuit of the attackers. There have been previous cattle raids in this cross-border area, but not on this scale. First Vice President-designate Riek Machar's return to Juba has been delayed again. SPLM-IO officials say their leader's return to the capital today was delayed until tomorrow because of logistical challenges. Tight security was visible around the capital today in anticipation of Machar's arrival. And finally, the Sudanese Journalist Network is criticizing a renewed crackdown on freedom of expression by Sudan's National Security Service. The Journalist Union says two daily newspapers have been shut down by the government. A statement from the network condemns the confiscation of the Al-Takir newspaper, which occurred twice last week, and the El-Saya newspaper 2 days ago. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Sudan by Panda by SOB.
Yeah, SOB only. No, I know you feel the same thing I felt for Sudan. Yeah, SOB in the hood. Yeah,
Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda,
who bang a thing of body,
who bang a thing of body.
My homeland, S-U-D-A-N, Sudan, is the biggest, smallest, greatest, poorest, richest, like a young, beautiful African girl, fed in love with hydra-headed leaders, shared by fame and ambitions, ripped by petroleum and religions, and forsaken by all, with exception of jungle boys, Nase, Akhe, Kise, Lafe, Bera.
Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda,
who palgeting a party,
who palgeting a party, who came by Panda, oh, Sudan by Panda.
We've been listening to SOB with the song Sudan by Panda. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mm-hmm.
Nyoko kwa Afrika, kawota novu Afrika temal. Nyoko kwa Sudan, kwa novu Sudan temal. Matkana matki mon, heran goreje. Matkana mat Afrika, heran goreje. Matkana matki Sudan, kon goneje. Gona mat, gona mat.